Hello, Wangs. Welcome to the Rest is History members special. And I've got a huge treat for you because every time before we do this, Sam goes through the Discord, takes out the highlights, serves it up to us on a attachment. And I just printed this out. And Dominic and I were looking through it beforehand. And we have a question about the discussion of the reputation of Winston Churchill.
God, you're going in very strong, Tom. Hello, everybody.
Yeah, going in hard, going punchy. And this is following on from the members' debate that we had, the members' thing that we did about reputations. And C.C. Baxter, discussion of the reputation of Winston Churchill. He thinks it's problematic that he's venerated more now than he ever was in his lifetime. Sigil Breaker 26, Churchill was racist. He thought less of people of a different race. That's simply undeniable fact. It doesn't matter if his opinions were common. Roger replied, have you heard of the term anachronistic? So clearly it's all been kicking off on the Discord. And I was asked, do we want to go into this? And I said, no, not really. It's Monday morning.
I know.
Do I really want to plunge into a huge debate about Churchill being racist? But Dominic, you said you have strong views.
Well, I do have strong... I mean, you'd expect me to have strong views, Tom, wouldn't you?
Of course I would.
If I didn't have strong views about this, my life wouldn't be worth living.
So I said that you know, this is kind of strong meat for a Monday morning, but now that you've expressed the fact that you have strong views on it, I'm happy to sit back and listen.
I can't believe you went in with this. So I thought it would be a nice gentle introduction to the bonus episode. You've gone in. So C.C. Baxter thinks it's problematic that he's venerated now more than ever he was in his lifetime. Is he? Well, I'm not sure that's quite right, actually. So when Churchill died in 1965, all these famous scenes of, you know, tens and tens of thousands of people queuing to pay their respects, hundreds of thousands.
And the cranes lowered, didn't they?
The London Dockers dipping their cranes over the River Thames, a colossal collection of world leaders assembling at his funeral, tributes from all sides of the political spectrum. So his great rival Clement Attlee calls him, you know, the greatest Englishman of our time, the greatest man. Basically the greatest man of our time. So Churchill's pretty venerated then in the 1960s. And they're not having the arguments that people have now. So you could argue his legacy is more contested now than it was at the end of his life, certainly the end of his life.
A straw in the wind in the 60s, though. John Winston Lennon changing his name in, what was it, 1968, 1969 to John Ono Lennon.
Yes.
And as ever, a trendsetter.
Oh, Tom, how could you go down that
road? But don't you
think?
I mean,
well, yes, I suppose so. I mean, but that actually completely captures, I think, one of the aspects of the debate, which is this kind of Oedipal. Don't you think this, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure it's Oedipal. But I mean, the sense that the
kicking dad.
The kind of the rejection of the shibboleths of one's, of the previous generations.
Exactly. Which is a lot of what this is right now, I would say. Bill, interestingly, one thing you didn't read out, Bill, on the Discord said he wonders why FDR doesn't get the same admiration in the USA. That is completely true. FDR doesn't get anything like the same attention. They're just such different characters. I mean, it's Churchill's larger than life character. Plus Churchill was a frontline politician and a media celebrity for far longer than Roosevelt was.
But also, I mean, America wasn't faced with the realistic prospect of invasion and occupation.
Exactly. Now, as for Churchill and race, I mean, this is very conflicted. And actually, just to say, Churchill, Sigil Breaker, Churchill was racist. He thought less of people of a different race. That's simply undeniable fact and all this, that, and the other. That it's actually, the truth is actually a little bit more complicated than that. So Churchill does say sometimes some very aggressive things, but he also, I mean, famously says, I don't think you should, at one point he says, you should never judge people by their national qualities. There are good, bad, and generally indifferent people in all countries. So he says some quite sort of unracist things. I wouldn't go as far as to say anti-racist. I think it's just basically fair to say with Churchill, he's obviously very staunchly imperialist. He believes in the British Empire and in its sort of, he is absolutely unashamed in believing that he wants Britain to be top dog. And he says often very aggressive and insulting things about, but not just about people of other races, about people of all nationalities. And he says so much, often very flamboyantly.
Yeah.
And a lot of the flamboyant things he said, by the way, we get secondhand. So it's sort of Churchill said X at dinner or whatever. But you don't know how much these stories are being slightly inflated to kind of, you know, because everybody knows Churchill's a character and it's better if the character says outrageous things. So I think we should come back to this in an episode. I think it'd be a fascinating subject for a whole episode, Churchill and the Empire, Churchill and race. Because I think it's a much more
nuanced... haven't done Churchill at all, have we?
No. And we've often talked about it.
We have. So we've got a kind of list of absolute top grade subjects
that
we're trying to ration because we don't want to use them all up, you know, just kind of eat the chocolates all in one go. But Churchill's an obvious one.
He is. And would reward because... You know, the early part of his career is a bit of a sort of General Gordon coda, isn't it? In the Sudan and...
We were going to do young Churchill, weren't we? And then we kind of realised, having done General Gordon, that they were rather similar, so...
But the other thing I would say, Tom, just without completely going down the rabbit hole, is to take people from history and say, they were an X. Doesn't always work. I mean, you could say, for example, would you say of basically every historical figure from 400 to... 1950, they were homophobic, for example. I mean, would you say that? Because you could, right? I mean,
you could, but it would be anachronistic.
But it would just be pointless. It would be...
But it's important. I mean, the concept of homosexuality is a 19th century one.
Yeah.
So it's ridiculous to define people... I don't think that you should, you know, I think it's pointless to define people as homosexual before the 19th century.
Okay.
I think, you know, it's like saying Julius Caesar conquered France. I mean, it's kind of right, but it's missing something important. And again, I think the topic of homosexuality would be a great one to do. I very much look forward to doing that.
So, I mean, Mary Beard had a line, didn't she, about statues. She said she hated we should take down all the statues. I walk past them and I see the statues of people who thought I shouldn't get the vote and we should, you know, take them all down. But I mean, that's pretty much everybody who's ever been put up in a statue. There are very few statues of people who would have thought that Mary Beard should get the vote, aren't there?
Well, there are lots of statues of people who thought that, you know, basically people who didn't own a certain amount of property shouldn't have the vote as well.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what that proves. Doesn't I say exactly as though that somehow proved some crushingly profound point of mine, but it hasn't. But it's just, I just think to approach history from that from the perspective of sort of, if you don't conform to my personal moral principles, then you're out.
Well, Mary also said in that documentary that, I mean, she made the point that lots of people who were filming or taking photos of Colston being chucked in the river were using iPhones that are dependent on effectively slave labor.
Yeah, of course. It's that whole thing about, you know, roads must fall, but I'm happy to wear some shoes made in a Uyghur camp or something. You know, I mean, anyway, we have to be careful because I really don't want people to think the bonus episodes are just an excursion into the pages of the Daily Express.
So. No, I think it's, I think you're being more nuanced than that. I think it's a good teaser for a number of forthcoming episodes. So what else have we got? We've got a shameful thread here from Richard Miller. I mean, and it starts off so well. So there's a picture of what looks like a delicious meal.
Looks like he's at Hawksmoor or something like that.
And he's thanks Tom Holland for an excellent meal and decent company. And the decent company is Rubicon. And I thought, oh, that's lovely. That's so nice.
That is a nice way to spend an evening, I think.
And then Jeannie piles in.
Yeah.
So the meal was excellent, but the company was only decent. And then Richard Miller retorts, well, it was no Stanley Baldwin, IEU. I think it's gone downhill.
Yeah, it has gone downhill. And actually, if I was going out for a meal on my own, well, it looks like he's on his own. I mean, I'm not dissing him. Maybe there are lots of other people. But if I was going out for a meal and I was taking a book, I would take Rubicon, Tom.
Would you?
I would, yeah. I'd reread it. Because if I didn't have the pleasure of having you with me, I'd want to be able to hear your voice in my mind.
Well, I don't think that I'd take one of yours because I wouldn't be able to carry it.
Yeah,
I might drop it on my foot.
You could get one of your wangs to carry it for you.
Yes, I could do. What else we got? We've got Tim Top Vicar of Vasby Burney's been at it, tracing his family ancestry. And it turns out that Harold Hardrada is his great-grandfather 24 times removed. Romanus II, Byzantine Emperor, 27 times. Mstislav I of Kiev, 23 times. So he's right in there with...
I find this implausible. Tom.
With Kiev and Rus.
I find this implausible. I could add others, he says, including Alfred the Great and Attila the Hun. I don't believe there's anybody who can trace their descent from Attila the Hun. Is that possible, Tom? You know more about Attila the Hun than I do.
I mean, isn't it possible to trace your descent from everybody?
I suppose so. I mean, isn't everybody descended from Charles II or something like that?
Edward the Third, I think.
Edward the Third, right.
Yeah, so Adam Rutherford, brilliant, you know, absolutely got his finger on the pulse of all this kind of stuff. And he endlessly explains to me how it's possible that we're all descended from Edward the Third. And my brain just goes into seizure.
Yeah.
And I still don't understand it. It's like when people explain gaslighting to me. I don't know what that is, actually. People have explained it over and over again, and something about it.
It's when somebody's doing something to you, and you say, oh, you're doing that, and they say, oh, no, you're just imagining it. Isn't that what it is?
Yeah, it's like the film.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen the film.
No, the film's very good.
Is it Hitchcock?
It's very kind of Hitchcock-ish.
Okay.
It's a woman who marries a dashing yet ultimately sinister man who is deliberately driving her mad, but then uses the fact that she says she's experiencing all this stuff as evidence that she's mad. But I still don't see how that maps onto... That's the problem I have.
Okay. I definitely don't see how that's got to do with Tim Vasby Burney. I mean, he's not gaslighting.
I don't know. No, he's not. Well, maybe he is. I don't know. I wouldn't be able to tell. Anyway, Dominic, we're slaloming all over the place here, like the British Olympic, Winter Olympics.
This is what happens when
not picking up medals.
When you start with such an extreme subject, Churchill and race, and then just scrambled a...
So give us something else.
So just to go back to that reputations thing, somebody I mentioned earlier, so Veni Vidi Lanzini mentioned Clement Attlee. As a child of the 90s, I'm not sure the place he held in the collective political imagination. I'm not sure of that place, but it certainly seems to me he's been rejuvenated initially by Corbynism's need for a historic and successful Labour figure which could match his own political agenda. I think there's actually some truth in that. So Attlee is, having written my own books about the sort of 60s and 70s, Attlee is kind of absent from the national imagination, I would say, in that
period. As in Churchill's joke?
Yeah, as in an empty... Which he never told. So that's a great Churchill apocryphal. So Churchill has this story, an empty taxi arrived at the Palace of Westminster and Mr. Attlee got out. But Churchill never said that. And actually, once he heard a young Tory MP or somebody dissing Attlee, and Churchill told him off, don't ever speak, you know...
Of Major Attlee.
Yes, a very fine man and a great patriot. You know, so actually, Churchill did hold Attlee in high regard. Now, I would say Attlee has been slightly reinvented. There is that sort of Ken Loach film, The Spirit of 45. And I think the Labour Party, especially under Blair, when the left wanted to sort of say that, oh, there could have been another way. There was another Labour Party that isn't this dreadful centrist. They sort of held up and Attlee, frankly, of their imagination rather than the one that existed in reality, was often much more small C conservative. And they sort of said, oh, the radical, tremendous radical achievements of the late 40s government, Attlee, wonderful man, and all this. And you could start to get T-shirts at the Labour Party conference that would say, what would Clem do?
Send donations to Haileybury, I think.
Yeah, he would, exactly. He'd have gone
his
to
old
watch,
private school.
He'd have gone to watch his old boarding school play cricket. Yes, that's exactly what he'd have done.
He would. But, I mean, isn't the ultimate measure of Attlee's revived reputation that he won the rest of his history, the World Cup of Prime Ministers.
Well, what's happened is that he has just sort of become the canonical successful Labour Prime Minister. Because, frankly, I mean, I don't want to be mean, but the Labour Party, if you're not going to include Tony Blair, then Labour Party sort of partisans are slightly struggling for William Pitt, the younger William Gladstone, sort of Churchill, Asquith, kind of titanic figures. Because Harold Wilson's a bit of a letdown. Tony's obviously evil. Gordon Brown's a bit, you know, a bit of a damp squib. And then what have you got?
But I mean, isn't it a problem for Corbynism? That I mean, particularly thinking at the moment in terms of the figures from Corbynism and their reaction to Ukraine.
Yeah.
And they're absolutely kind of painting it as the fault of Britain and America rather than of Russia.
Yeah.
That's not the kind of attitude that Attlee had.
No. Well, Attlee founded NATO. So, yeah, absolutely. And he and his foreign secretary, Ernest Bevin, were absolutely central in the origins in the beginning of the Cold War and taking a very sort of stern line and so on. So, yeah, there is on all of that, Attlee is a very, very poor totem for the left.
Anyway, so Babylon. Many were interested in Babylon's links, its links with Rastafarianism. Harry Lloyd Prentice commented on this musical theme. I can't have been the only person who half expected Tom to open the episode with a rendition of By the Rivers of Babylon.
Well, we sometimes like to surprise you.
We do. I mean, it was so obvious, as in the Rasputin episode, where we left the quoting of the lyrics of Rasputin, rah-rah Rasputin, to be a kind of delayed shock. So we occasionally like to pay tricks. But then you have had me sing Rivers of Babylon on a previous bonus episode. So
yeah, so you've done actually.
So all good things.
Sometimes
come
you like to
wait.
Save the real treats for the bonus episodes, don't we?
And talking of Rasputin, Dave Waters, Dominic, asks, okay, Tom Holland has risen to the Boney M song in A Voice from History Challenge in a truly magnificent and entertaining way. Can we expect Dominic to deliver the chorus of Rasputin in the manner of Winston Churchill? So Churchill coming back here.
I mean, I've done Churchill already in this podcast. There are times when I think to myself, Tom, you know, when
You've
I
got
did,
dignity.
When I did my PhD and I spent a year in an archive in Minnesota, it wasn't so that I could do Rasputin. Sort of, Rasputin, lover of the run. I can't even, it's absolutely laughable.
No, that's very good. You've done it. That counts. that counts.
Go on. The bonus episode for 1st of February. Oh, because we obviously talked about your great plan to do an episode about the history of pigeons.
Yes. And an ornithological Ned.
Well, of course, he's going to like it.
Give us an episode on pigeons. The passenger pigeon is a fascinating and tragic story in anthropogenic extinction. It is.
So we should explain. Yeah, you met Gordon Carrera, who's a very distinguished BBC correspondent. Defence correspondent, I think.
He kind of does spies.
Right.
So that's why he's interested in passenger pigeons. I mean, sorry, in pigeons.
Yeah.
Is spies kind of sending messages by pigeon.
And he said he'd like to come and talk about pigeons, or you... I don't know whether
so he said he'd like to come and talk about pigeons and about, you know, sending messages and spies and all that kind of thing. And I went, brilliant, passenger pigeons, dodos. And he slightly blanched at that.
Right. Is he an expert on pigeon fancying as well as...
I think he covered that.
Because obviously pigeon fancying was a massive thing in sort of, you know, mid-century, early 20th century Britain.
Well, it's very you.
It is. I don't really know as much about it. I did. There was once a point where I knew an awful lot about the ownership of budgerigars.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Because that was very mid-century, you know.
Dust the notes off that.
I will do. I'll have to dig into it. I think we should just do, perhaps widen it out to domestic birds in general.
Well, actually, I mean, I think that the role that animals have played in history is a very interesting, so the horse would be an obvious one.
There's a brilliant book actually by a German guy called Ulrich Rat something. Anyway, he's German. He wrote a book called Farewell to the Horse, which I made my book of the year one year because it was absolutely riveting. It was in translation and it was basically horses were so important in human history and now they're not anymore.
Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating topic. And there's a very good book by, I can't remember. But about
there's some excellent reading recommendations in this podcast. Yeah, no, that poor guy who does the reading lists. Like, it's a book about a horse.
Oh, I've got it somewhere. I'll look it up and I'll post it. I'll post it on the Discord when I can find it. I made it's very good.
So pronounced Murray had a very interesting point about civil wars because we've talked quite a lot about what causes and what defines a civil war, and pronounced Murray. I'm assuming. Well, he or she says that they've been thinking about the Jacobite Rising. Saw conflicts in both Scotland and England, armies made up of soldiers from both nations while being supported by Jacobite sympathisers across Britain, but it's not viewed as a civil war, ? It's not viewed as a civil war. I don't think it's generally a civil war if it's started by an invasion. Do you, Tom? I think it has to start inside the... and also it has to last longer. You need more than a kind of one or two battles.
I think it's a Scottish civil war. So yeah. it's the Lowlands against the Highlands.
But it's too short, Tom. It's so short.
It is. But the way in which I mean its effects last quite a long time, and I think that it is, you know, in the Scottish context, best thought of as a war between the Lowlands and the Highlands. And I think you know quite a lot of. Historians of Jacobins do see it in those terms. I agree that in the kind of broader British context, it isn't. And I agree that it's because it's an invasion. Although thinking about the smuggling episode we did with Alex Preston, pointed out that even in, in Kent and Sussex, Jacobinism is having an impact there. And southeast of England is as far away as you can get from the launch pad for Bonnie Prince Charlie's invasion.
Yeah, it's true.
So interesting. So maybe there is room there for...
You wouldn't call the Glorious Revolution a civil war, would you?
It's kind of a civil war, isn't it? I mean, it's...
But again, it's over quite quickly. I don't know. I think a civil war...
I mean, it's not a civil war because James II runs away.
Yeah, yes. But it could have been...
He goes to Salisbury and gets a nosebleed.
Well, that's what happens when you go to Salisbury.
Well, only if you're
Didn't happen to Ted Heath.
Only if you're a tyrant.
I think it needs to be more protracted to be a civil war, because otherwise, you know, a coup is not the same as a civil war or an invasion. I mean, anyway, these are all sort of grey areas, aren't they?
They are. Yes.
I still think the civil war episode, I wish we'd done that later, because I think we did that very early on when we did shorter episodes and we did them quite broad brush and in a hurry. And I think there's actually so much more to be said about.
But isn't that the fun and the freedom of a podcast, that we can go back and do it?
We can. Yeah.
That we should.
Okay. Very good. So disease. Now, this was absolutely one of Tom's. Tom, you were so excited about doing disease with
yes,
Carl Harper, weren't you?
I was.
You were delighted to. We've had lots and lots of questions about it, and I think you want to go into some of these, don't you?
Well, there was one again from Mary Kirk Alves. She asked, "Was your question, Dominic, regarding the Columbian Exchange ever answered? Was there disease transmission back to Europe and Africa in the 15th and 16th centuries, or was it a one-way voyage of disaster?" I mean, it was mainly a one-way voyage of disaster.
Yeah.
Because the germ pool in the old world was much greater than in the new. So I looked to see what Kyle had said. Syphilis is the disease that was long thought to have been a new world disease brought back to the old. That now predictably is.
So that would explain when England played Spain in 1996, Euro 96, Tom, I can vividly remember. So the Daily Mirror was in a very jingoistic vein that summer, under the editorship of Piers Morgan. So they did the famous Achtung Surrender,
yeah,
front page when we played Germany. But when they did the when we played Spain in the quarterfinals, they did a list, top five things that Spain has given the world, and number one was syphilis. It was on the front page. I remember it vividly. So that would explain why they thought it was, because they must have thought the conquistadors, yeah, the Sun's, you know, historical correspondence.
So, Carl says, I mean, this is something that has changed over the past few decades, I guess, since Piers Morgan was editor of the Daily Mirror. Carl says, on balance, it seems that syphilis needs to be classed as yet another affliction introduced by Europeans, even though treponemal disease was not unfamiliar in the Americas. I don't know what that means.
There's on this question of the Columbian Exchange, two of the most interesting history books I think I've read in the last 10 or 15 years are by a guy called Charles Mann. One's called 1491 and the other's called 1493. And they're about... The first one is about the world before the Spanish arrive. So it's sort of biological, anthropological, sort of social, cultural history. And the other one, 1493, is about the world afterwards and the extraordinary story of the Columbian Exchange and pollen and vegetables and all these. And it sounds kind of a bit dry, but it's absolutely...
No, it doesn't at all. I mean, it sounds unmissable. I must read it. I mean, on that topic, so there are some diseases in the New World. There are a few, and he lists them. But the thing about them is that they're not capable of causing major epidemics. So therefore, but what he does say about the impact of the Columbian Exchange on the old world and disease, he writes, the history of disease in the old world during these centuries was also dramatic. So that's the 16th, 17th centuries. Famine and war created the conditions for pestilence, institutions that brought together crowds of people, armies, jails, hospitals, and factories. Created new disease ecologies, a specific early modern disease regime dominated by smallpox, typhus, and plague held sway. And his argument is that the discovery of the New World, the introduction of new vegetables, crops, whatever, the wealth that comes from the New World facilitates very distinctive new society that then breeds very distinctively new variants of diseases.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So I think that is, I hope, is the answer to Mary's question.
That's a good argument. Do you want to do any more disease, or do you want to move on?
I think that's enough disease. Vikings in the East, question from Burning Archive. I would be interested to know if you think the TV show Vikings and other TV shows and video games capture the strangeness of Viking culture, religious practices, as well as the breadth of their contact with many societies, including the Slavs and the Rus.
So have you seen Vikings, Tom?
That's the problem. I haven't. I was going to, because there was a chance that I was going to have to go into hospital and have a fairly lengthy recuperation. And I decided that my recuperation viewing was going to be all the series of Vikings. So the good news is that I didn't have to go into hospital and have this operation and recuperate. But the bad news is that I haven't had the chance to watch them.
I've seen the first series. I think it does go in quite hard on the kind of shamanic, is that a word? Aspects of sort of Viking religion. It does capture the kind of weirdness, and it does capture the sort of sinister Ibn Fadlan funeral kind of side of things quite well. But then they get to England, and as I remember, It was when they got to England that I thought it all went. I didn't like it because the English seemed to me to be in castles, and they and they looked like people from 14th century France.
That's very wrong.
I was they should have looked. The reason that they did that obviously was because the series wanted to stress the contrast, whereas actually the truth is, of course, when the Vikings got to, they were so similar, exactly.
Yeah.
The Christianity being the only big difference, I suppose, really.
Okay, and another from Mary, Kirk Alves, who's on fire this week. She's curious about the settlements and the women. Once the forts were established in Novgorod, Kiev, etc., did the Vikings send for their women, assuming they did not bring women along, marry the locals, or just finish their tour and return to Scandinavia?
So I answered this on the Discord, talking about Iceland. So when the Vikings went to Iceland, we know from sort of DNA evidence that they clearly had slaves captured in Ireland, didn't they? They had female slaves. I don't know whether people would have sent for women, I mean, from Scandinavia. I think they'd have gone back, wouldn't they, Tom, rather than...
There's a recent book on this, which is very good, and I recommend wholeheartedly, which is Kat Jarman's River Kings.
Yeah, I've got that book. It's a great book.
It's very good. And she kind of traces a Cornelian bead from where it was found in, I think, Lincolnshire, wasn't it?
I think Repton in Derbyshire.
Oh, it was Repton. Yes, it was Repton. That's right. But she goes up to Lincolnshire, and then she goes to Scandinavia, and then she ends up going all the way across East Europe, ultimately to India, to Gujarat. And she has a whole section on this question. And I think it's fair to say that the evidence is unclear.
Yeah.
So anyone who wants to know more about that, I think that's the most up-to-date.
That's a very good book, isn't it? Because she's an archaeologist who specializes in...
And it's herself, I think, Norwegian.
Stuff to do with DNA.
Working in Glasgow.
Yeah.
Very, very on top of all the evidence.
Okay. So our old mate Capel Loft is getting a lot of love on the Discord. I know there are some people, Dick of Axe, of course, famously displeased at the thought of angry wangs being invited on this show. There are different views. Daniel, very impressed by Capel Loft, pronounced Murray, thought he came across like a contortionist tying himself in knots. I actually think that's a tiny bit harsh. I think Capel Loft is very consistent and he has a very sort of clean, firm line, which I don't necessarily agree with. I think a general consensus, though, that Charles I, we probably weren't too harsh to Charles I, don't you think, Tom? That Charles I made a lot of very bad decisions.
No, I think we were definitely right.
Yeah. Elena's dad, Charles still comes over as both unlucky and a terrible decision maker, but somebody has his people's best interests at heart and saw the radical Puritan capitalism as a threat. Well, you see, I think Capel Loft is slightly... He would be outraged at me trying to have the last word, but I think he's maybe slightly projecting his own political interests onto
his Tory socialism.
His Tory socialism, exactly.
Yes.
I think basically he thinks Charles I is Harold Macmillan. now, there is a really interesting question here, which actually would be a good podcast, because, of course, Capel Loft was the thing he really accused us of was wiggery.
Yeah.
And there was a big discussion about whether you were a Whig, Tom.
Yeah.
And somebody said to me, what do you mean when you say Tom is a Whig? And I said on the Discord, progressive, well-meaning, metropolitan, hangs around with the merchant class, citizen of world, habitué of Brookses, suspicious of the common man, sacral.
Well, Whigs aren't sacral.
No, they're not sacral.
That's the whole point.
That was a joke.
Yes.
Tom, would you call yourself a Whig, do you think?
Well, I think if you belong to Brookses, by definition, you're a Whig, aren't you?
Yeah, you probably are. And I think you are quite Whiggish. You believe in progress?
No. Well, you see, so this is the thing. If you basically say liberals are the heirs of the Whigs.
Yeah.
Which let's open a can of worms. But I think that would be, for the sake of this episode, let's take that as read. I'm instinctively a liberal. I mean, that's basically what I'd like to believe.
Yeah.
But the one of the kind of aftershocks of writing Dominion, writing about Christianity, is realizing that basically, you know, it's all essentially variation on Christianity. And so therefore, I guess that I'm a liberal, or if you want to say a Whig, who's lost his faith. I want to continue to believe in it, but I don't really believe in it.
You don't believe in Whiggery?
I don't believe in Whiggery. I don't believe in progress.
You're just going through the motions. You know,
I kind of want to believe it. And I do think, you know, things have, by and large, I do think that things have got better. I do think that, you know, I'd rather live under the current political system than under the political system of the early, you know, 17th century. So to that extent, I guess I do believe in progress, but I don't believe progress is inevitable or an expression of some kind of abstract purpose.
You're going to London literary drinks parties and expressing, you know, contempt for Donald Trump, but your heart's not really in it. It's all hollow. Is that the truth?
No, it's not that. It's that I can see no kind of transcendent justification for saying that liberal democracy is inherently better than, say, you know, a violent autocracy.
So that is a, I mean, I was being glib earlier and you're being more profound. So you are like a kind of, so that would be the difference between you, that would be the difference between you and Tony Blair. Tony Blair would say, you know, sometimes you need to stand up and liberal democracy is just better. And you have lost the ability. Well, you don't think there's an absolute standpoint from which one can.
But Tony's a believer.
Yeah, and you're so not. So
it requires a kind of leap of faith.
To Whigs, that's interesting, isn't it? Well, Whigs more. I mean, there's sort of in the popular imagination, the very sort of simplified version, Whigs are more idealistic and Tories more cynical. I mean, that's the sort of the stereotype, and it is just a stereotype, I think. And the other thing, I suppose, with Whigs and Tories is the city and the country, isn't it? That the Whigs are the sort of party, 18th century party of.
So in that sense, you're definitely the Tory squire and I'm the Whig.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I think there's a sort of, the interesting thing about Whig and Tory is that as Capel Loft said in that bonus episode, it's as much temperamental as it is programmatic or ideological, isn't it?
Mm, yes.
It's sort of, Whiggism and Toryism, and this would have been the case for Dr. Johnson, you know, who was a Tory, that Whiggism and Toryism are expressed in cultural preferences and tastes, fashions and choices of reading and all these things, as much as they are in belief about tax policies or anything like that. Okay, this is a massive topic. So
we are going to do this, aren't we?
Whigs and Tories. It's a good topic.
We're going to do Whigs and Tories. We're going to do kind of the reign of Queen Anne. And
all we are thinking about how politics started, I suppose.
How politics began, yeah. And then we move finally on to Smugglers and Simon Girdleston. Loved this episode, as Hawkhurst is just down the road from him, and he's been fascinated by tales of the infamous Hawkhurst gang since he was a child. They really were utterly villainous.
I loved that episode, I have to say. Now, I'm betraying nothing when I say Alex is your friend. You play cricket with him. You said to me you'd booked him, and then right about 3 days before the episode, I discovered he was a novelist, not a historian. So I kind of raised my eyebrows. And I found that really fascinating, and he really knew his stuff, I thought. So
as I told you he would.
Really enjoyed it. And I thought he had a really interesting, and his line was salutary because it wasn't what I was expecting. Very unromantic.
It's one of those episodes where a guest comes on and by the end of it, you know, your understanding of a subject has been completely transformed. Captain Insano, interesting discussion at the end around the veneration of criminals. It's still a pretty big thing here in Australia with Ned Kelly. So we should do one on Ned Kelly.
Yeah, I know nothing about
Ned
Kelly.
That'd be good. Who's traditionally been portrayed as a Robin Hood-esque hero of the people, standing up as an Irishman to the authoritarian colonial police. I just see them as cop-killing criminals. I mean, you can say the same about, you know, lots of the figures in the Wild West who've been
the Wild West. Or Alex on the smuggling episode mentioned the Krays, the gang, the London criminal gang of the 1950s and 1960s, and I completely agree with him. I think I find the veneration of such people absolutely repellent. But of course, it's easier to say that when it's your own country, isn't it? So it doesn't bother me that much about the mafia in America. You know, I love The Godfather as much as anybody.
Oh, Dominic, have you seen The Curse, which is currently on Channel 4? I know you never watch
television.
British TV. It's very good. It's a gangster kind of heist thing set in the 80s.
So you were telling me about it.
Yeah, it's great fun.
Yeah.
Great fun.
Okay. What are they paying you?
Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. It's very funny. And there's one character in particular who I just occasionally put on the trailer just so I can hear him talk.
Okay.
And then relax. Okay. I'm surprised no allusion was made to post-prohibition smuggling and moonshining in the US. Yes, it was a very Anglo-centric episode.
It was English. It was very Daphne du Maurier. But you're right. Prohibition is a fascinating topic. I used to give an incredibly boring lecture.
Well, you must do that again for the listeners.
About prohibition. But I think I could do it in a more interesting way now that I've reinvented myself as somebody who does
great accents. Who does a Boney M song.
Exactly.
Well, actually, I mean, we've got Al Capone on
on
the St. Valentine's Day.
Yeah, it's very romantic, I thought. Yeah. Very romantic touch.
Yes. Obviously, we are both, well, we're not, you know, we're British. So inevitably, I guess, the vast majority of our terms of reference are going to be British. Yeah. And we apologise for that.
I don't apologise for that.
To a degree, to our non-British listeners. But I just to say that your forbearance on that front just makes us value you all the more.
All the more. We have a lot of non-British topics coming up. Because coming up, we have we're going back to the last days of Rome. We will be going to China in the Cultural Revolution.
We've got this week.
We've got American Crusades.
How Americans have used religion or understood religion and war.
We have the Last Emperor of Mexico. Yeah. We will be doing in the future the Jewish Revolt, and we will also be doing one of the great. We will be solving another great mystery, Tom. Which is the
who shot JFK.
And before people on Discord say it, I will be saying he did it and he was right to do it. I won't.
That's your catchphrase.
So on that note, lots to look forward to. And thank you as always for being part of the rest of his history. And we will see you soon.
Bye-bye, Wangs.
Bye-bye.